This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Rachel Signer. We'll talk to Rachel about Pipette, her new book, You Had Me at PetNat, a natural wine-soaked memoir, and more. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Straight out of D.C., Rachel Signer attended college in Virginia, headed to New York to get her master's at the New School, along with the intensive writing program at the City University in New York. She settled into freelance writing gigs while waitressing in Brooklyn, writing for various outlets including Vice, Vogue, Eater, The Guardian, and Wine and Spirits, before starting her own wine publication, Terra, eventually becoming Pipette. Pipette is a quarterly on its ninth issue and is an ode to natural wine and everything around it. Rachel just published her book, You Had Me at PetNat, a natural wine-soaked memoir. So, Rachel, the question begs to be asked, how did a nice Jewish girl from D.C. wind up in Australia with a guy named Anton Van Klupper? A baby girl and her own natural wine label and magazine. I guess we're going to get the answer to that soon, and I don't think I'm going to have to pull it out. All right, welcome to the Grape Nation, Rachel.
Thanks, Sam.
I'm very excited to have you on because I love the book, and I have not read every issue of the magazine, but I've read a bunch, and I don't know where I was on that one. So, all right, so we're talking to Rachel remotely via Zencastr, our remote app. Rachel, I'm going to ask you where you are right now, and I'm going to suspect that your answer is going to be better than anybody I've had in the last year. So where are we talking to you from?
I'm on our farm. I'm in the house, and I'm looking out the window, and there's the big shed, the winery. We call a winery a shed here in Australia.
Is that the green one?
No, that's the blue one. The green one, okay. If I crane my neck, I can see it. It's just a little bit down the hill. And around us, we've got some very baby vineyards growing. In the distance, there's a slightly more established vineyard. And I can't quite see the veggie patch, but there's lots going on.
So it's very rustic. I was going to say vineyard farm, but I think it's fair to say we're talking like permaculture here.
Yeah.
You know, which is really a convergence of, you know, what you just described is really permaculture, which is animals, vegetables, vineyards, right?
Permaculture is very specific, and it involves very like a certain way of growing things. And that's not quite what we do. But, and we actually don't have livestock at the moment. We did have sheep, as you might remember from a certain
yes.
scene in my book. But
yes.
So we do have a lot of biodiversity. We've just been planting, dozens of olive trees. We made our own oil from the existing olive trees and it was so good. We decided to just kind of double down and just make enough oil that we don't ever need to buy it and possibly that we can maybe sell a very tiny
nice.
Amount. And we have fruit trees. So we've been increasing the life and the diversity a lot. That's sort of what we've been doing in the pandemic is like
right.
improving the farm. So it's kind of less rustic and more productive and more kind of cared for than it used to be.
Right. I remember reading that you would go to a friend's house or farm to get the olives. Now you're growing them on your property, right?
Yeah. Well, they were on our property.
Oh, they were? Oh.
They're just kind of on the other side. Yeah. But they those are trees that Anton planted now probably 8 years ago.
How long does it take to bear fruit?
I think they took 4 or 5 years. They start out
okay,
very
so
small.
You're ready to go. All right. So, Rachel, I just need you to help me with one thing before we really jump into stuff. Give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are. But I want you to bring me to a certain point, which is your trip to Georgia, which I think was a life-changing trip. And don't go into much detail before that, because the detail I want to get into, you know, Georgia involves Anton and, you know, changing life and all that. But, you know, just a quick trip to get me there, if you can.
Sure. I did not grow up in a family that emphasized wine or food. And they often sort of wonder how I ended up doing all of this. And my mom would say that it's because she grew vegetables and that me eating her organic food straight from the garden primed my palate. And I don't know if that's true, but flash forward, I was 28. I was writing a novel. Let's not talk about the novel, but I was studying fiction writing and I was working a couple jobs to make ends meet. So I waited tables at Renard, that used to be in the Wythe Hotel, was an Andrew Tarlow right. place. Lee Campbell was the wine director. So amazing, amazing people.
Really like legendary yeah. Brooklyn. OG.
I know. Well, they were like yeah. kind of amongst the first to really do natural wine. And, it was just amazing. Like, I mean, we served Pet Nat instead of Prosecco. Like most of the time, or right. Cremant. Cool. I think we had Cremant. But so I don't know what it was. It was love at first taste. I wanted to know more. And I was very perceptive to the way that people were talking about these wines, like Trevor, who probably you know from Discovery Wines. Kirk was there, Kirk Sutherland. Yeah,
sure.
is at... or was it Roberta's, but he was the coffee guy, by the way, but like, you know, and Lee, the way Lee talked about these wines, and I could almost visualize the people because they were so personified. And I was like, holy shit, wine is made by people. Like that's radical. And then, Lee has a background in political science and she just loved talking about the culture and the battles of natural winemakers against the Appalachian system and how wine regions have transformed over times. You know, like there's this idea that a wine is a static thing and that's so incredibly wrong. Like it's a bottle contains all this history of change over centuries to get to a point where it has that label and it's believed to be a certain thing. And I mean, as a background, having a background in cultural anthropology, but not having pursued academia, I was like desperate for something like that, something intellectual, but not to the point of academia. And I was, yeah, I just fell in love. But the restaurant job
right.
didn't
brought all those elements to you.
Wine brings you know. All of those elements together.
Yeah.
And natural wine has this added element of like, kind of working against the grain and being an outsider. And that was really interesting to me. I really related to that. So I worked
So Rachel, yeah. wait, not to interrupt, but what year are we talking about? Because what's crazy is you're going to tell me not that long ago. And, you know, for natural wine in New York, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, but it seems like ancient history. When are we talking about?
It's so amazing how much it's changed. That was like the second half of 2013. And then 2014 was when I worked at UVA and when I started doing wine journalism.
Would you say Uva was one of the early and first, you know,
supporters of natural
wine stores? Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It was like Uva and Renard doing their thing in Brooklyn. And I think probably Vine Wine and, you know, like a few other things.
Right.
Like Hotel Del Mono had natural wine too. Yeah, but Uva sold tons of natural wine. People would come from all around the city and just ask for natural wine. Absolutely.
Right. So you work there, you said, right?
Oh, yeah. I went in and I said I wanted to work maybe 3 or 4 days a week. And they put me on 6 days a week all summer.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So the writing part was something you wanted to do? Was it stimulated by wine and now you had a direction? I mean, so you kind of get exposed to natural wine at Renard's. You work around some great people. You go to the coolest natural wine store. How does the writing thing come about?
I had done a few bylines in various publications about food from a sort of political perspective. So I'd been writing about food in terms of who has access to it or the farmers market movement. That really interested me. And I just totally pivoted. And the first thing I landed was Food Republic. I knew an editor there kind of randomly, and he gave me a shot. So I became kind of their wine writer. And I wrote about food as well. And then at some point, after about a year, I asked someone, I was like, I feel like I should probably specialize in either wine or food, because it's like I'm straddling these worlds and they both require a shocking amount of knowledge. And they said to me, right, there's not that many women that write about wine. And I was like, okay, I'll go for it.
What were you aware then that there was zero or very little coverage of natural wine then? I mean, was this what you were doing and loved, so that's what you were going to write about it? Or you had this presence of mind that
it definitely took it took me a while to even realize how important natural wine was to me. So I was pretty much happy writing about wine in general for a little bit, but I'd go out and I'd just go to all sorts of portfolio tastings, but increasingly the ones that I loved were like, you know, the Zevrovin tasting,
right?
Like, or I like
Jenny and Francois.
Jenny and Francois, like the memory of going to Camille Riviere's first tasting for the first time is like burned into my memory. I think I was like sweating with excitement about all the wines.
Really? She was just on the show about a month ago.
It was I listened. It's great.
Yeah.
She's great.
I love her. Yeah. So you hit all that stuff and it just solidifies, you know, how you're feeling, what you want to do, what you like, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I did find over time that I was getting told, that's too niche. Could you write about something more general? And so I was starting to get a little frustrated, but I was also having the time of my life. I was getting invited to Oregon and the Finger Lakes and Europe. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I had no money. I was definitely racking up credit card bills because nobody pays you, obviously, when you go to these trips, and then the article you write is you get paid $200. So it was going well, but I mean I can tell you a turning point that's not in the book if you kind of want to know, but I drove through the Loire Valley for a week in 2015. And I went hard. I visited 4 producers a day, which I do not recommend. And I met basically all of my idols. Laurent Saillard, Thierry Puzelot, he's in the other region.
Right.
Sorry, hold on. Who's the guy that makes Romorantin? Oh my God, I can picture his labels. My brain doesn't work.
Worry about it.
Yeah. Sorry.
But so, you were able to kind of go to the guys that meant something to you.
Oh my God. And I was like, there were people using Georgian amphora in all throughout the Loire Valley. And I was like, that is a story. Thierry Pouzelot getting Georgian amphora over to the Loire Valley and people using it to ferment like Remorantin is a story, and nobody wanted it. And right. I was like, I need to write a book about this. I was going insane. And I was like, I'm going to self-publish. And that's when I started to work on Terre, essentially. So,
So the magazine was an outlet for you to focus, you know, on all of this, right?
Yeah, I was consumed by the need to like tell these stories. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So we'll get to Terre in a few minutes, but you know, I guess it's fair to say that, you know, natural wine has been this, you know, personal journey for you. You know, certainly what you just said, you know, where you got in a car in the Loire and, you know, kind of visited all your guys. You eventually got to Georgia, which is where, you know, I mean, it's ancient winemaking. They use amphora and amazing people, amazing wines, and you met some significant people there. Let's get right into the book. It's, I think I'm accurate in saying that at first it seems like an ordinary story about a woman trying to find herself, you know, her aspirations, you know, her love life, of course, has to be sprinkled in. And also in this case, you know, natural wine, which is significant. But to me, it develops into this, you know, crazy, unlikely story. So first, a few mandatory questions, and I'm more interested about the story. But this book, when did you decide to write it?
I mean, I was discussing a book about natural wine as early as 2016 with...
Okay, so it was always in the... ether somewhere to maybe do.
I thought I was going to write it from using Paris as my base. And that was kind of my premise. And I was like, okay, I'm going to move there and write about living in Paris and natural wine. And they're like, maybe. And then I was like, I'm going to start a wine bar with my best friend. And that's going to be the story. So that was slightly possibly more interesting. But when I finally went to Paris, I had absolutely nothing solid lined up at all. But some of the chapters I did write early on, like I think pretty soon after I worked Harvest at Domaine Moss, I tried to write it out because I felt like I just wanted to remember everything.
Right.
Yeah. And the Renard chapter as well. I wrote that years and years ago because that time was so like vivid. And so, as you point out, very like, there is a lot of personal element in the book and working at Renard.
You know, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't.
Young and
it, but you're
vulnerable
sort of,
and confused.
Well, yeah, your love travels, you know, nothing abnormal. I mean, men come into your life, you know, some pay attention, some don't, some are right, some aren't, you know, that type of thing. So that's a big part of it. I think Paris is a huge part. You know, we're barely scratching the surface on how important Paris, you know, as a vibe and you wanting to be there is. But a lot of the book, you know, is covered around that. You know, I know in the book you mention, and there's sort of an interesting story, you know, you wrote diaries and, you know, Anton got, you caught him reading your diaries. Is the book based on those diaries, or those were just put aside and, you know, it's different parts?
Oh, I definitely used them to remember things. Absolutely. I mean, they're very helpful in that respect. Yeah. I mean, I think in a way when I started writing the book, I sort of stopped keeping a diary so intensely. I've started again, but now I kind of write it differently. I think in a way, possibly my whole life, keeping a journal was a way of working up to writing memoir. I love memoir. I read a lot of memoir. It's an amazing right. and like slightly underappreciated, slightly misunderstood genre, but I think it's an incredible literary form. I mean, yeah, like Anais Nin's diaries are some of the best works of literature from the 20th
yeah,
century.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that's why I felt so attached to this book. I mean, I love Victoria James' book. You know, it was kind of shocking to me in a lot of ways. But I think that form is really, you know, very interesting. You know, and then we have friends that only read fiction. So, you know, who knows what people are thinking. So as much as the book is about natural wine and, you know, its ethos, which again, I want to discuss too, because there's this whole world and community, you know, this whole sort of eccentric, hedonistic obsession, you know, with natural wine, you know, which we want to talk about. But I think one of the important things about the book is you traveled a lot and you document that travel. And, you know, I'm going to throw a few places out to you. And, you know, you had mentioned Mossy. We're talking about Georgia. You wound up in Australia. There were a couple of places in between, like Sardinia. But tell the story about how you met Anton and where. And let's get into how that, you know, kind of changed your life. And you gave him a nickname.
Yes.
I think you were, I'll set it up a little. You know, I think you were in Paris, you were in New York, you were traveling, you talked about writing, you know, you weren't making a ton of money, you were focusing on what you wanted. And here you're on a crazy trip to a crazy sort of wine region, Georgia, and you bump into a guy, and I guess we could say that was life-changing. So talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, talk about sliding doors. Like, what if I hadn't gone on that trip to Georgia? That's interesting to me. But I did. I was invited, essentially, an importer invited me, and I was on this. I think the Georgian government does fund these groups because they've realized how important their wine industry is to their overall market. So it was an amazing group of people from all over the world, winemakers, importers, sommeliers, and everybody with some kind of focus on natural wine. And I had just never been in that setting. I'd always been in a setting where it was like myself and five or six wine journalists, and I was the weird one because I was
because it wasn't mainstream
into natural wine. And so this was a total reversal. It was so great. And I mean, Georgia, if you haven't heard about it at this point, it's just such an incredible wine culture, oldest continuously producing wine culture in the world. Very interesting political and cultural history and great, great wine, amazing, gorgeous wines, natural wines.
Right.
So yeah, there I am. And I'm back in New York. I've got everything ready for my move to Paris. I've sold all of my belongings. I've got my two suitcases packed and ready to go. And I go off to Georgia for this 8-day trip. And then I meet someone. So I call him Wildman in the book. It's like, I guess, a sort of literary device to create distance. It's extremely difficult to write about someone you love. It's very hard. And I think that helped me using that as a device. And anyway, I knew of Anton and I knew very little about him. But I knew his wines to me were like otherworldly.
Lucy Margot are his wines, right?
Yeah, I'd had them twice, and they had both been like life-changing wines. And I still like them quite a lot, even though I drink them very
Why? Often. I mean, give me the descriptors. I mean, you know, our listeners, you, me, we've drank a lot of natural wines. Yeah. But why did those wines make that impression on you?
I think, first of all, something to point out is that my palate was basically educated on natural wine. And that's important because I think a lot of people, if they do a WSET course or they are a professional sommelier for 10 years, whatever, and then they discover natural wine, all they're going to notice are the quote unquote flaws. But
flaws.
Yeah, like volatile acidity, et cetera.
Mousy.
I can't drink mousy wine straight up, but something like volatile acidity to me is actually very interesting in a wine. And my palate has just mostly been educated on natural wine. So the taste of a wild ferment is beautiful to me. And when I first tried Anton's wines, he had just started to go sulfur free, and that vintage was particularly wild and it had a lot of volatile acidity. And I just loved them. They were electric. They were absolutely electric. And I remember the Vino Rosso that I had, which we drank in Paris. The scene is described in the book. But it was the way the fruit, it was like the way the fruit presented, it was neither here nor there. It wasn't like big and juicy. It wasn't like sour and acid. It was all of that at the same time.
Right. Which I guess it's an art to, you know, get wines, you know, to be that way. Also, Anton, you know, talk about the fact that, you know, at this point, I think at this point in the interview, people should understand, you know, that you follow this path of natural wine. You've been writing about it, drinking it. But Anton was this natural wine figure in Australia. And if people remember, Australia was known for these big, overblown, you know, Syrahs. And here's this guy pioneering a movement, right?
Yeah, he, along with a few other winemakers.
Right, not single hand.
Absolutely. They kind of created that path. And actually, the story is told in the book for the first time in print. Of sort of how they did that and some of those very early moments. So, yeah, I mean, it was a hard road. And I think the more I got to know Anton, and essentially, I think what I have understood over the past 7-8 years is how much people have fought to do this, to make natural wine. They have everything against them. They have the wine associations telling them they don't like their wines and not giving them any support, or kicking them out of the appellations if they're in Europe.
Right.
You know, they don't have big investors because nobody does that in natural wine. And they have lots and lots of expenses, and yet they do it anyway. And I think it's like for the sake of making something really beautiful and for the challenge. But yeah, I mean, now there's
big commitment.
It is. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know, you could see in the book, you know, Anton's life and, you know, the life that you, you know, eventually got into. I mean, you were really, you got to be all in, right? I mean, it ain't happening unless you're all in.
That's right.
I mean, it's just, you know, an amazing thing in that sense. So the interesting thing with Anton is, and clarify this for me, I guess when you met him, you knew of him and there was a certain, you know, charisma or attraction initially, and that piqued your interest. And what was it, by the end of the trip, you guys connected in one way or another, right?
Yes, that's right. And he was in a complicated place. He had recently become separated. And I do talk about that in the book. And I think readers will see, you know, it's a perfect storm of two people with difficult places finding each other and having to really reckon with what that means, if that makes sense.
Well, let's talk about that, because he was coming off a marriage, you know, after years in the teens. He had a teenage daughter. You know, he was very intensely involved in his business, you know, so that's one side. You, on the other hand, how would we describe this? You know, you wanted to live in Paris and be a writer and open a wine bar. You seem somewhat non-committal. I mean, I think you were yearning for maybe some kind of relationship, but isn't that where, you know, the big difference was? You were intent continuing on that path, right?
I think if you look at some of the early moments in my book where I talk about relationships that I was having, you would say that I did not have probably enough self-respect and confidence. And I think there's a lot of I mean, everybody can be in that place at some point. That's a normal place to be in your 20s at some point. But I think it's partly a product of having lived in New York City, and you are kind of surrounded by glamour. It's very easy to compare yourself to others. There's a sense of competition that I don't think exists in probably smaller cities. Obviously, that would all be
even in natural wine. I mean, they compete, but they try to help each other.
I think people in natural wine are pretty amazing, but it's only one culture within the culture. So I think I just was, I was struggling. I mean, I lived month to month for years in New York. And I think that is not such a nice way to live for years on end. And I don't know why I thought
even
Paris
in Paris. I mean, it's amazing how it's amazing how a person, you know, can live like that. And, you know, that was one of the few things you complained about the least. I mean, yeah, you complained a little, but, you know, there were a lot of other things that, you know, were more pressing to you. I just thought that, you know, you were like the most unsettled person, you know, it's just crazy to me. So let's get back to Anton. So here you are with that lifestyle. You know, we just talked about it. Here's a guy, you know, coming off a marriage, you know, on a farm, which we described earlier in the show. By the end of your Georgia trip, he gets to you enough where he has your attention, right? Like, here's a pretty cool guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he likes me, and he's sort of making these more than overtures. You know, I think he invited me or whatever, you know, but so what's your thinking? It's like, wait, that's not what, you know, I'm this Paris thing wine bar. So just tell people what you were thinking then.
When I got to Paris, yeah, he was on my mind still, and we were in touch. And then he very quickly started making plans to come to Paris. And so kind of that entire summer, I was like in touch with him and waiting for him to come. So that was definitely an unexpected twist and turn. And it was like a bit.
Does that distract you enough from not going out much because you're thinking about him, or you kind of juggle it all?
That's what I was going to say, is that it was like surprising to me how difficult it was. Like I wanted to be present and enjoy Paris. And,
right.
You know, I had dated someone there like previously, and I was like, excited to kind of keep dating him. And then I was like, I'm just not interested in him anymore. Shit, what has happened? Like, I'm supposed to be young and free and single in Paris. But I was actually really, I was thinking a lot about this guy that I had just met who lived in Australia. I was very confused by that.
Yeah, and you had some big decisions to make. And, you know, we'll leave it for people to read the book. But, I mean, the relationship develops, you know, where you're really, you know, put on the spot to figure out, you know, what to do with your life. You wanted to pursue your life, but I don't think you met a man like this before. And I don't know if you wanted to let that go, which is a really, you know, important part of the book. I mean, he presented an enviable problem for you, right? It's sort of like, you know, here's a loving guy, you know, that'll let you pursue your literary dreams and, you know, be in the wine world, or just back that off and be who you were, right? So what'd you do? You, for a little bit, you kind of juggled it?
Well, I mean, it's important to remember when I worked Harvest at Domaine Moss, and I won't spoil it too much, but I think there were no indications that I should ever make wine. Like, I was very overwhelmed by the Harvest experience, and I kind of came off it like, well, I'm never doing that again. A couple months later, I took my first trip to Australia. Then there was like a year of kind of back and forth, like Europe and Australia. I don't know. I like to make things
emotionally. Were you leaning more towards, you know, this is a guy in a life I want to pursue, or you still weren't even as sure then?
I think it has. No, it's been a long period of adjustment. Absolutely. Like, people often say, oh, you're living the dream. And I'm like, I don't think anyone understands what it means to live on a remote farm. I mean, this is going to sound sort of like a stupid example, but I haven't had food delivered to the place that I live in like 5 years. We have to cook every single meal.
And it is funny, but I totally get it. You know, you're right. It does sound funny, but you know, if you read the book, you'll understand it because, you know, way more detail is filled
okay,
in.
Okay. Yeah. Just a big, huge adjustment. And so I grew up in a suburban culture. So it was just totally unfamiliar to me, but I was really swept away when I first visited, the beauty of this place and the beauty of Australia in general, and
but romanticism. Rachel, but what happened the first winter?
Yeah, winter is hard. And I mean, I'm not alone. People do comment to each other here, like, oh, you made it through the winter. And like someone said to me the other day, like, do you remember your first winter in the hills? It just rains nonstop. It's a bit like Oregon, probably.
Right.
It's just three months of rain. It's wet and muddy and really nasty. You get very little sunlight. And the past 2 years have been extra hard because we can't leave. So,
right.
Yeah.
That gets tough. And you get lonely. You know, you start questioning everything. All right. We have to take a quick break. We're talking to Rachel Signer. Rachel is the publisher of Pipette Magazine. And she just wrote a book, which is coming out about now, called You Had Me at Pet Nat, a natural wine soaked memoir. At the end of the show, we'll tell people, you know, exactly when and where to get it. Rachel, when we come back, I want to talk a little about, you know, your travels. It's sort of a little wine travelogue. Let's talk about some of those places. We talked about them a little. I want to talk about, we talked about Anton and his wine, Lucy Margaux. A nice part of this story is you became a winemaker. You have your own wine label. And I also want to talk about the magazine. So we still have a bunch to talk about. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Rachel Signer. Rachel is the publisher of Tare. Rachel just published a book that is coming out now called You Had Me at Pet Nat, a natural wine-soaked memoir. And Rachel, let's jump into this. We'll do the travelogue after. You have your own wine label. I forgot to ask you offline. Persephone, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. Other people also say Persephone, but
That's what I initially thought.
Yeah, but so either is fine.
I took a stab at that. So natural wine is an important world to you. You drink a lot. You're intrigued. You know, you ultimately married, you know, one of the greatest examples of a natural winemaker. Didn't seem like early on in your sights was to become a winemaker, but you become a winemaker. I'm not sure if my counting's right, but you could be in your fourth or fifth fifth vintage at this point. It's sort of an interesting story how you became a winemaker. If I know it right, I mean, tell everyone. I mean, Anton played a very heavy part. Being on the farm was important. How did you become a winemaker?
Oh, Anton played all of the part. I had no desire to make wine. And he kept saying, you should come, you know, stay for vintage, stay for vintage. And for whatever reason I did, he basically said, why don't you make a barrel of wine and like, you can sell it and do whatever you want. It'll be great. And I was like, okay, sure. That sounds like a really good idea. And then I ended up making 5 barrels of wine, my first vintage. It's actually very difficult to do anything with like 1 barrel. I don't know. So, yeah, that's, and I guess a turning point for me was that somebody had a basket press kind of sitting around and I looked at it and I was like, I want to use that because, and I had never, you know, I think, sure, I'd probably seen a basket press, but I'd never really thought about that as like a deliberate choice before. It wasn't.
Describe what a basket press is. So I mean, you're pressing grapes, but just so people know, you know, it's a little out of the ordinary and you were doing it alone. Just describe, you know, what it is.
Yeah, it's an old fashioned press that doesn't, it's not electrically powered. You don't need to plug it in or press any buttons. And it has these like wooden kind of staves on the outside and that they go in a circle. And then on the inside, basically you put in the grapes. There's a few different kinds of basket presses, but you put in the grapes and then you put weights on top of them. And then you use a lever to increase the pressure. That's it. It's very
manual. And it squeezes the juice out of the grapes. Right.
It literally squeezes the juice out of the grapes. And then you collect it in like a bucket and put it into whatever you're fermenting in. In my case, it was barrels. And I was like thrilled the first time I used it because it was, I don't know, it just was like, it was calmer and quieter. I didn't have to plug anything in and press all these buttons and stand around like a dummy while I watched the men, right, you know, operate the machinery. Like I could do it without any instruction. And that was kind of empowering. And I was like, that's what I want to do. And I kept on doing it. So yeah, I have done 4 vintages of wine. I've increased slightly, but not really. So I made... 2021, I made about 2,500 bottles. So that's why my wine is like slightly difficult to find. Right. It's because it gets exported to a few places. Obviously, I sell like a little bit in Australia. And yeah, I mean, to
quickly
describe
talk
it,
about the varietals. I mean, you made, I think, a Gamay.
Yeah.
Did you make a Sangiovese?
Yeah. So there are 3 main growers that Anton has been working with for a while. And over the years, he has, so he basically, you would say he leases their vineyard more or less.
Right.
And they work together on the farming, organic farming, obviously. But he has grafted, this is so amazing about a vine. I mean, it still blows my mind that you can literally graft one variety. So you can take Sauvignon Blanc rootstock. It grew as Sauvignon Blanc. And then 5 years later, you can like cut it off, put Gamay on top of it, patch them together, and it grows Gamay the next year or maybe 2 years later. Like that is mind blowing. But that's why
it's
we
crazy.
Have so many different varieties because of that work Anton did. So yeah, these growers have Gamay, Sangiovese, a lot of Pinot Gris, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, quite a bit of Merlot in one place, a little bit of Semillon that was like kind of unpruned for a couple of years. this and that.
That's
this
okay.
And that. And there is some Pinot Noir. I made Pinot in 2019.
Isn't there a little Pinot like right on the property, you know, growing wildly?
So,
yeah.
20-ish years ago, Anton planted that vineyard before he even lived here. He had the land first, and he decided not to irrigate it and not to spray it. as a sort of experiment.
Didn't he even stop pruning it?
At one point he stopped pruning it a little bit.
Right.
But they have not, so some parts have done better than others, but we have kept one part and we have retrained it so that it will grow as a bush vine. So we've removed the wires and they will grow. Like if you've ever been to the Roussillon, if you Google Roussillon bush vine, that's the best example I can think of because they are so glorious in that region in France. But I think that those do quite well and they seem, I think, to be more defensive against mildew.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, people have an idea in their mind, you know, what vineyards look like, rows, you know, with wires and all of that. It's quite the opposite. You're being humble about a couple things. One is, you know, you took the press, and usually when people make wine, they all gather together and make it. My understanding is you did a lot of this alone, right? And it's the type of thing that maybe you shouldn't do alone, but you kind of did it, right?
Oh, never again. I mean, it was a terrible idea.
That was your first vintage when you basically did it alone?
Yeah, obviously since then I have made sure. Oh, definitely have help. Oh, it is so physical. Like, especially now as a mother, I think I would actually collapse if I didn't have at least one person helping me with the whole process of pressing the grapes. And I mean, the thing is, you have to understand during a vintage, if you haven't done one before, you wake up at 6 a.m., you pick from 7 to like, I don't know, 2 or 3, and then you drive to the winery, somewhere in there you eat, and you start processing the grapes. And you do that until 2 a.m. or whatever.
It's crazy, like, life. Thank God it's not 12 months a year. You would pass out, you know?
Oh, that would not happen.
The other nice thing was, you know, when Anton said, here, make a barrel of wine. And I guess you were fairly content. But, you know, it seemed to me like he came back and said, hey, try these grapes, make another barrel, you know, where you were just happy to make one. You know, you made multiple wines that first year, which is, you know, it's reflective of Anton's generosity and interest. Yeah. I mean, it's just.
He lives to like support people with their dreams, especially if they dream of doing something with organics or with natural wine. Like that's really important to him. And that's what he loves to do.
So that's part of, you know, the world of natural wine, you know, where it is much of a community. But my takeaway is, you know, is Anton is that like times four. And I think one of the things that supports that is talk about your trip to Sardinia, you know, why you went there, who you visited, and, you know, what you offered, you know, what came from that, which really explains who Anton is and what the natural wine community is about.
Yeah. And, you know, the story of Panavino and Sardinia is only like partly told in the book. At some point, a book has to end, right? But I can tell you what happened.
As does this interview. I mean, we could sit here for 5 hours, but like, you know, those are the frustrations. Go ahead.
Panavino is a winery in Sardinia that I loved from my New York days. It's a Louis Dresner import in the States. And we are friends with his Australian importer. And they're actually like very close. So our Australian importer like normally hangs out there for a couple of weeks every year and just enjoys. And so basically what happened is that in May 2018, there was a 45-day spurt of rain, and it just obliterated. I think because there was no sunlight, the vines couldn't flower. So basically any fruit-producing tree or a vine, it has to flower before it will create fruit, and it needs some light to do that. It needs photosynthesis and pollination, and it just didn't happen. So there was like zero grape harvest, and that's just devastating financially and emotionally. Sure. For any winemaker, especially like a small winemaker. But so we went and visited, and I mean, gosh, I mean, yeah, John Franco, you could really see he was devastated. But we had a lovely visit, and essentially Anton, kind of in liaison with Giorgio, basically said, you need to come to Australia. There's grapes for days. Like, we'll find you some organic grapes. There's plenty of room in the winery. You'll stay somewhere and come. And he did. He came the next year. It was very, I mean, John Franco doesn't travel much.
It was a big deal.
I don't know when he had left Europe in his life, but not recently. So it was a very difficult adjustment. He brought his son, Izako, who's so cool. We had a great time. And then they came back and bottled the wine like later, and it's out there. So they did it. They recuperated their losses. They made
it's amazing.
Yeah, they made good money.
It's an amazing story.
And I don't know, maybe when borders open, like, they'll do it again for fun, or maybe we'll go there and make wine if they have a good harvest 1 year. It was really amazing. Like, I love, so their first language is Sardo, not Italian, but they spoke Italian right to us. And I just love the Italian language. Like, that's what vintage was when I first came to Australia. It was super international, and we've lost that these past 2 years. Or just the past 1 year, and probably this coming year, but someday again.
Well, the offer was, you know, an incredible act of generosity and support. You know, you said it went so well, and you made the point that, you know, maybe we'll do it again or go there, you know, to forget COVID for now. But, you know, it's just such a cool thing, and that's part of the community, which is really nice. Another interesting stop, and you talked about it a little, but get into it a little more. The Loire is maybe ground zero for natural wines, and you went there sort of to intern and work a harvest, and you worked with the Mossies, you know, which is one of the great winemakers. And I think you found out that interning and making wine's not an easy thing. Talk about, you know, the back-breaking experience that was.
Oh, and I didn't even like work every day. I mean, I admit this in the book.
That, well, you were like a guest, but still.
I mean, yeah, like, I was an intern and I was unpaid. And so because of that, I guess if I felt like doing something else, I could. So there was like one day where I just went with Renee, the father in the family.
The mom,
To do the shopping, which for an American right in France is like very exciting, because you go to the market, you go to the butcher, it's very exciting. Right. Yeah, and then I had to like explain to all the workers, they're like, where were you this morning? And I'm like, oh, about that. But yeah, like it is very physical and very hard. And yeah, even now,
just
like
clipping grapes for hours. Right?
Oh,
it's backbreaking.
It's so hard. Yeah. Well, Burgundy is even worse. I've done like a day of work in Burgundy before, and the vines are so low down to the ground. Like, I think for air circulation, right, it's excruciating. I've seen people use all sorts of things. Like, somebody attached like a bench to their butt. It was like,
everyone's getting creative. Yeah.
I think it was duct taped around their waist or something. It was the smartest thing. So they would just sit down and be sitting on a seat and then get up and go to the next vine. Amazing. So if you ever work harvest, you know, do something like that probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the power of, you know, ingenuity and innovation, what makes life easier. Because of the pandemic, obviously you haven't traveled much, plus your mom. We talked about if you could travel, you haven't seen your family. It seems like 3 years, which is, you know, mandatory. But if you could do a trip, would it be a wine trip? Would it be Paris to see GABA? I mean, where would you bolt out to?
It would be both of those things, but we would like to have some kind of home base in Europe, because it's for a number of reasons. One is to have a relaxed experience instead of I think traveling with a kid is really hard, and you need like a place to be where you can cook meals and you're not imposing on your friends, and you know, your kid can have tantrums and have bad sleeps and whatever.
Look at you settling down and being sensible.
Oh,
counter to the first half of the book.
Can I tell you how much I love sleep? Like, I'll do anything for sleep.
Sleep's the most underrated thing ever. And when you have kids at the beginning, it's like
very
a non
important.
Thing. That's a cool thing down the road, maybe to have, you know, a pied-à-terre or some kind of place somewhere.
Learn the language and not be a tourist is kind of the other thing I was going to say. We don't like being tourists at all. We prefer to have a feeling that we are somehow part of a place and kind of really living there.
I want to do a thing called the wine list with you, but we didn't talk about your magazine, which I think is a wonderful publication and a very important part of your life. You started a Dream and a Passion project called Terre. You know, it was a literary wine magazine and beyond, certainly food and all that. That morphed into Pipette. Obviously, you know, this was an early obsession of yours. Did you start the magazine for your own writing independence? And also we discussed, you know, that natural wines and that whole community wasn't getting the coverage. I mean, was that the early days of Terre, or did it morph into that?
Oh yeah, also to work with other people and to publish interesting illustration and photography. I think I was interested in being an editor. I mean, it's kind of a natural move when you've been a writer for a couple of years.
Right.
And that's what I am now primarily. I mean, most editions of Pipette have one or two articles by me, or in some case, a few cases, like none. And then I've just been the person behind the curtain pulling all the strings. That's been awesome. I'm not sure if you're aware, but issue 10 will actually be the final edition. So
I wanted to ask you about that, because I'm not sure where I stumbled on that, if it was in issue 9 or something I read somewhere. So we're on 9 now. Sometime in October, 10's going to come out, right? And you're saying that's the last issue. Why?
I think I just need a break, and I've started to realize specifically what it is. I think I need a break from the commercial stuff. So like when you're when you run your own publication or your own business, you don't really, I mean, maybe you can afford to have somebody do all the admin and the sales and stuff, but in my case, no.
You were doing it?
There's no way. So it's really worn down on me. I have a capacity to do sales and admin and number stuff, but it's not what I like doing.
Your life is different now too.
Yeah, my life is different. So every hour that I'm on the computer is like an hour. I'd like to spend more time with my daughter. It's going to be summer here. I just want to like be outside with my kid, and we have vineyards that need a lot of work. So just taking a break from magazine publishing, and then
it a break? I mean, you'll take a break and you think you may find the urge, you know, to reboot it, you know, just issue 11 of Pipette or a different form, or
I think that may just dissolve? No, I think it could be very interesting to continue in some form, whether that is a website or a podcast or the same print magazine with perhaps a different configuration where I don't have to do the admin. I don't know right now.
Well, you'll have time to plot that out. Interestingly, it was print only, you know, in a digital world. So you'll worry about that next move. Does this last issue reflect the fact that it's a last issue, or you put it together just as an issue and then decided it was the last issue?
Oh, we knew. I knew for the past
you did. Okay.
12 months. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a strong issue. I definitely tried to I felt like I couldn't close Pipette without having Matassa in there. So we got a profile on Matassa.
Yeah. That's great. All right. So at the end of the show, we'll tell everyone, you know, where to get it. And I'm very sad to hear that you're stopping, but hopefully, like you said, it'll come in different iterations, if not the same. And then at some point, you're going to help me get my collection of 10. So we'll talk about that another time, because I think I'm obsessed and I need to own them all now. But that's another thing. All right. So last, we do a thing called the wine list. But before we get to the wine list, as a parent, and I know how life-changing kids are and everything, and it's just been the greatest pleasure of my life. You witnessed your dear friend Gabba become a mom, and now you're one too. I think your daughter's a couple years old, so motherhood is, you know, fairly new to you. Tell me how that whole thing puts everything in a different perspective, and I'm assuming it's changed your life.
Oh, yeah.
How?
I mean, the perspective is just always about providing her with opportunities, and I actually think I feel really good about my life choices, seeing how she's growing up. I mean, she will know exactly where food comes from, and she'll know how things are made, and she'll know, like, I mean, she's not quite at the age where she can help. She thinks she helps.
Right.
But she will be able to do that at some point. And I think she'll just be exposed to so much. And I hope that we can also give her the experience of, like, cities and non-Anglo cultures and all of that sort of stuff as well. But she, yeah, it, it's...
But the root of it, in Australia at the farm with Anton, you think that's just a marvelous, you know, place and exposure, you know, for a kid to grow up. I mean, I do, obviously, you know, it's different than a kid growing up in Manhattan or something, right?
Yeah, which is another amazing way to grow up. I mean, I think, and there are some drawbacks as well. We have a shortage of schools here because we're so rural. Like, there's sort of no high school. A lot of parents end up driving their kids to an expensive private school in the city. But, you know, I think we just want to have fun with her right now and just really
that's what it's all about.
Enjoy the time. Yeah.
Happy and healthy. It sounds like a great thing, and it sounds like, you know, a very special thing in your life. You know, we discussed Anton and the farm and your life, and, you know, having, you know, your child in there just really rounds things out. So that's a beautiful thing. All right, we're going to end on that. I want you to answer my wine list. I ask every guest that comes on the show the same 5 questions. We don't have a lot of time, so I don't want you to dwell on the answers. Be spontaneous. You can give me a few answers. Maybe you've seen or heard the list before. But first question is, Rachel Signer, what are you drinking now? What are you tasting? What are you curious about? What's in the fridge? You know, besides your wines and Anton's wines, is it friends' wines? Is it even beer? So what are you drinking now?
We got a little bit of Georgian wine the other day. So we have a Ricozzatelli, a 2015 Ricozzatelli from Our Wine, they're called.
Right.
Like O-U-R, Our Wine from Georgia. Right. It's great. It's super intense. And Anton gave me a glass last night without telling me what it is. And I was like, this is so intense. What is this?
What's the grape? I mean, is it red, white? Is it a skin fermented?
Ricozzatelli is a white grape. This definitely
it's white.
Definitely has skin contact. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that I asked that question shows you my depth of knowledge in natural wine, which is more than most people, but nowhere near. All right. So Georgian wine, that's a good one. Anything else come to mind?
We have a very small amount of Aurelian Lafort's wine, and that's like, it doesn't much leave France, so we're quite excited. He's this guy in the Auvergne. I would just drink any natural wine from the Auvergne region. It's a favorite, but his are really beautiful. They're very like ethereal. They're not too acidic. They're not tannic. They're just kind of in this in-between place. He does like Gamay and Pinot, a little bit of Chardonnay. Yeah.
Nice. I didn't mention, but we post all our guest wine list answers. So the reason we do this is
I'll just
so
say
that our
one
guests...
more because there's so many amazing female winemakers out there. It would be like crazy not to mention one. So La Villana. So that's featured
V-I-L-L-A-N-A.
Yeah, double L, that's right. She's in Lazio. In the region north of Rome, just by Lake Bolsena, which is volcanic soil. Her wines are amazing. They have some slightly local grapes. So they have Percanico, which is like a version of Trebbiano. And yeah, right. Her wines are stellar. She's American. Her name's Joy Cole. And she's actually featured in issue 9. So you can read about her.
I saw that. I didn't read every article. I will go back to that. Do you know Michelle Smith Chappelle?
That rings a bell.
She was an American. She was a sommelier. I think she worked at Brooklyn Fair. She fell in love with a French guy. She now lives in Beaujolais and makes wines with her husband, David. And she has, I think, her third kid. You know, sound a little familiar? It's just a cool story. All right, second question. You guys are into food. Anton has the restaurant, which we didn't really talk about. You talked about the vegetable patch. He likes to cook. I like to eat. You like to eat. Give me your favorite wine and food pairing. Not something you eat every night, every week, as I always say, but something that just, you know, makes a lot of sense.
Okay, we eat a lot of pizza.
Okay, who doesn't? Go ahead.
Well, we finally figured out how to make it ourselves, and we have like a pretty big herb garden. So we just, it's really nice to use fresh herbs, and we make our own sauce, passata. So generally, we love just Gamay, absolutely.
So homemade pizza and Gamay. You think Gamay, and I'm not questioning this, you know, with any tone or anything, but you think Gamay is a great pair with pizza?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
See, totally. I like Gamay with anything, but I haven't eaten it a lot with pizza. I got to revisit that.
It's so nice.
Pizza and Gamay. So you're talking a red sauce? Are you talking any cheese on there too?
Lots of cheese, definitely.
Okay. All right. So pizza and Gamay. All right. Let's figure this one out. The question is your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. Usually I talk to people, they're from big cities, and I say to them, you know, who's got a good wine selection? Where's their vibe? People who know about it, you know, if it's a natural wine bar, like my friend Jorge at Frenchette, you know,
yeah.
I want to talk about a vibe.
I can talk about one in Paris.
Go ahead. That's so the answer, what I was going to tell you is anywhere that comes to mind.
Okay. Well, I'll just say one in Paris because I think probably some of your listeners are like trying to finally go to Paris after not being able to travel. So there are so many places, but one that's very special to us is called La Cave à Michel, and it's just on this tiny, tiny street in the, oh, I guess that's the 10th. Probably. So
okay.
It's on the right bank. And La Cave à Michel is like a closet. And behind the bar is like Roman and Julia, and they're a couple.
You talk about them in the book a few times.
I do. Did read it. Okay. So yep. Roman is like a very amazing chef, but he decided to cook on like a what do you call that? Like a little burner?
Convection oven?
That's what it is. Like just a little tiny gas burner.
Toaster convection oven. Yeah.
And so he makes like a broth like that is served in a bowl and it's just incredible, like a bone broth. And he also serves mayo, so eggs mayo, but he does it
I forgot that. Right.
Hard boiling eggs and putting them in front of you on a very interesting wire kind of arrangement with a bowl of mayo. So that's your oof mayo. And it's perfect. Right. So that's so good.
That's La Cave à Michel in Paris.
Yeah, which means like Michel's cellar is what it means. And it's a joke because there's no Michel. But it's so great. It's standing room only. And people like just stand around and you just drink and you have a few snacks and you stay as long as you want. It's great. It's perfect. But the things he cooks are beautiful.
That's why we ask you guys these questions, to find these little gems. All right, fourth question. Favorite all-time wine? The question was originally structured to be asked, Rachel, what's the most expensive rare wine you ever drank? Don't care about that anymore. What I care about is, what's that wine that was significant in your life? Gateway, life-changing, important. And as I read the book, there are probably a few instances that make sense. But tell me that important wine to you to this day.
Oh, God. I'll say one.
Or a couple, you know.
Yeah. Can I say whatever one that's not in the book, I think? Because
yeah, no, it doesn't matter.
It
doesn't
like a broken record talking about this one pet nat. But I think Kenjiro Kagami's white wine, his Chardonnay, is astonishing. So Kenjiro Kagami is a Japanese man making wine in the Jura, and his wines are total unicorns, and they are completely natural. There's nothing ever added to them. They ferment in barrels in a small cold cellar. He doesn't He holds them back for a while also, so they're often released aged, or you find them aged. They're just stunning. They're
hard
to
get, right?
Yeah, but sometimes you try those unicorn wines and you're like, whatever. But this one is really, really good.
Yeah, I've heard of them before. I've never tasted them. So the Kenjiro, what is it? Kagami.
Yeah,
I got it.
It's Domaine de Miroir, mirrors, domain of mirrors.
All right, so we're going to post that. All right, last question. The question is, you know, I talked a lot of psalms, a lot of winemakers, writers, all of that. You've been around this enough. The question is, recommend the best wine around $15, $20, $22, a red and a white. You know, I told you I have kids in their 20s. They can't show up at parties and give, you know, crappy supermarket wine. They can't afford $40 bottles. So how do you wow at like, you know, $15, $18, $20? I'll take the price tag off for you. Talk to me about what you think the best values in wine are in a red and in a white. You know, it could be a region like Muscadet is a good wine. That's a great value. What comes to mind for great value wines?
Oh, yeah. No, I was the queen of that. That was like my specialty, was like affordable natural wines when I worked at UVA.
That's right. You worked retail.
Yeah, no, I love this question. Do you know what comes to mind is it's very easy to find. Benjamin Taillandier. You would, maybe if I said La Gazelle.
You have to spell it for me.
Sure. Taillandier, T-A-I-L-L-A-N-D-I-E-R. But
does
it ring a bell if I say La Gazelle? Can you picture the label? Big red letters, La Gazelle.
Yes.
I know you've had it. It's like maybe $20 or $15. It's just, it's nice, cheap red wine from biodynamic vineyards. It's great.
That's a good one. And the fact that it's biodynamic. Give me one more.
Sure. I would like to give a shout out to a neighbor called Jauma Wines. You've probably seen Jauma. It's definitely, definitely in the States for like years now. And Jauma is just amazing wine. And I think he works really hard to keep the prices down. Like Australian wines can be a little bit expensive, but I don't think his wines are too expensive in New York. And they're just beautiful. He does some Chenin Blanc, occasionally random other white grapes. Like I think Verdejo has been in there. And he does like, if you like richer reds, like Syrah and Grenache. Yeah, great stuff.
All right, so those are two great recommendations. I will post those. That's as good as it gets, and you're a good a person to recommend those. We have to wrap the show up. I don't even know if we scratched the surface. I could stay on for another 2-3 hours, because in my mind we broached subjects and I like to get into stuff a lot more, but we leave that for the listener to go out and buy the book. You had me at PetNat. So let me do a quick wrap up, and then I want to tie everything together where people can get more info and find everything. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Subscribe, you know, hit the subscribe button. You wake up Wednesday, Thursday, and there's Rachel's interview right there. You don't have to go chase it down. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. I always say that's a little confusing, so you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation on both. We're trying to build a little community on Clubhouse, so follow us there at BenRuby. As I mentioned, we will post Rachel's wine list. I will have all the details, the correct spellings, all the information. And if I can't figure out, I will email Rachel. So Rachel, a bunch of things. If people want to follow you, where can they follow you on social media?
It's at Rach Sig, RACHSIG, both on Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah. Okay, now let's talk about the magazine, Pipette.
Yeah. At Pipette Magazine on Instagram, not on Twitter.
And if people want to get the current issue, the new issue, maybe even try to dig up back issues, they can go to selected like wine store retailers. How do people get
it? The best thing is to order it from pipettemagazine.com. Most of the retailers, I mean, they might have some back issues, but I don't really know. Unfortunately, we're sold out.
Well, let's concentrate on current. And now that you kind of said the last one, you know, people may be, their interest may be piqued to see that and own the last copy. So pipette.com?
Yeah, pipettemagazine.com.
Magazine.com. All right. And the new book is You Had Me at PetNat, a natural wine-soaked memoir. I am assuming Amazon?
You sure can find it there, but you know what you can also do?
Where should we go? Small bookstores?
You can use bookshop.org, or you can literally call, or if you can walk in, you can walk into your local bookshop or use their website and order it from any bookshop that you normally go to. Like, I know Books Are Magic in Brooklyn has it on pre-order. I think most of them do. So wherever you normally buy books, that's where it is.
Right. So, Rachel, I led with Amazon. Let's stay in the vein of supporting your local bookshop and go in there and look for it or ask them for it. That's the play. You know, we're natural wine peeps. Let's stay within that mindset.
Totally.
All right. Then we have your wines, Persephone. Persephone, not easy to get, not impossible. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah. So the states.
And while you're doing that, Lucy Margaux wines.
Oh yeah. We have, the same importer. And so
who is that?
It's Chris Terrell. My wines for sure in New York, in California, and in Oregon. So, for example, I know Bar Bandini in Los Angeles, amazing little bar. They've had Persephone almost every vintage. Henry's in Brooklyn, Bushwick, amazing, amazing shop. I did actually work there for a little while. It's an incredible spot. So they usually have some of my wine. I think June Bar has had it before. And then in Oregon, I would try Bar Norman, which is Dana Frank's spot. I would try that and see if they have.
Okay. And then I'll check with you offline if there's anywhere else, you know, I'll post it. But, you know, it's a limited run wine. You know, it's coming from Australia. It's obviously not going to be everywhere. You just dropped a whole bunch of places where you can get it. You know, obviously, if you live in Kansas City, it's not going to be a wine easy to find. So those are the places. All right, Rachel, my engineer Armin, when he sees me in person, is going to strangle me because I ran so late, but I couldn't help myself. So I want to thank our guest, Rachel Signer. Rachel, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. I hope to see you one day and to taste the wines. I want to thank our engineer, the very, 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 that was five verys, patient Armin. And everyone at the Heritage Radio Network, I'm Sam Benrubi, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.